Welcome back. My name is Kaz.
This is Medibot.
And this is definitely episode 63.
No question.
Of the Skulls Cast.
Skulls Cast.
We're going to start off with our segment, Skulls Asked, which
a bipartite segment.
Indeed. Which brings us to a question from Gnomebitten. You'll remember this one, Medibot.
Yes.
What do you think of the game mechanic of having different endings? Is it fair to have a bad end other than the standard game over? Or is the added depth of having a story that changes with worth the forced replayability?
Okay.
Having a story that changes worth the forced replayability.
I feel that the idea of multiple endings is a design choice, like any other, and is appropriate in some circumstances and inappropriate in other circumstances.
Right. I'm going to pretty much parrot Medibot on this one, because I feel the same way about this. It's sort of like asking me, what do you think about platforms in game? The mechanic of having platforms.
Yes.
And I would tell you, okay, having platforms is a really wonderful idea in the Super Mario Brothers, and it's a really horrendous idea in Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door.
Yes.
And that's... That doesn't say really anything about the virtue of the platform. I think
if you choose to have it, have a reason for having it, and make it work.
Yeah, we can find plenty of examples on both sides of this. I think to have like, oh, this game had multiple endings and it was great because it made sense. And
Chrono Trigger,
yeah,
had many endings
and
they all made sense.
It gave you a sense of your own ability to affect things, and they were good and interesting.
It's a game about time travel and changing the timeline.
But then you'll have really stupid-ass things like, I don't know, Fable 2, where the entirety of all, like, endingness comes down to one solitary decision at the end that you could just, like, throw the entire rest of the game out, and that's your ending, and it changes, like, precisely nothing about how the ending actually plays out and all that.
Mm. Mass Effect 3 and all that, which I haven't actually played.
Oh, does Mass Effect 3 do that?
You're given a choice of three different endings. My understanding, I haven't actually played it, but this was making the rounds for a while, people being upset about it. At the end of the game, you essentially choose what color of fireworks you want to blow up the bad guys with.
Ha!
Or something like that. I'm probably way off because my experience with Mass Effect is playing the first game for about 40 minutes, having no fun with it, and more or less swearing it off.
Well, I'm going to have a super surprise for people with regards to that in not too long. But I feel we've more or less covered the grounds of the question.
It is a design choice.
This is a tool. This is moral neutral. Okay, our second
list... Like raccoons.
Raccoons are a moral neutral?
They're morally neutral.
That's a different question to answer at a later time, I think. Our second question for Skulls Asked comes from Teal Hydra, who asks, I hear Medibot has some sort of teaching job now, and would love to hear about his experiences.
Alright, well, I don't want to say too much because, you know, I'm working with students, with minors. I don't want to be, revealing any potentially sensitive information. So I will have to speak.
Yeah, let them do that on their own, on Facebook or whatever.
Yes. That is their choice, not mine. But I think the thing that I will be sharing, I have been working in mathematics classes. And I have been working with students with limited English proficiency. Mm. And something that I guess I believed before I started doing this, but really got reinforced by doing this, is the idea of math as a language and the expressive power of mathematics, both in terms of, obviously drawing a shape. You know, when you're working with geometry, is expressive, but even just the expressive power of an equation. So I was working with a student, and I forget exactly what we were teaching at the time, probably something to do with equations, probably graphing, probably slope-intercept form, because this comes up a lot. And the teacher was explaining, you know, the procedure for doing all of this at the front of the class, and I was sort of sitting near the back near one student, and this student was very confused and very lost with all the things the teacher was saying, because of his limitations with the English language.
Mm.
And so he comes to me and says, "Hey, you know, I don't get it." And I say, "Okay." And I try, you know, explaining the thing. Like, you know, first I give the teacher's explanation again. No good. Okay. Now I'll give a different version of it. You know, maybe that's what this student needs. No, that's no good. And at this point, I was getting a little confused and a little lost because I try explaining it, you know, I tried a third and a fourth way to explain it, and it just wasn't getting through. So then what I tried doing is I took out a piece of paper, and I wrote an equation, you know, with X and Y or whatever, because we were working with that. Mm-hmm. And I point to it, and I point to it and like, "We start here." And he's like, "Okay." And I say, "Then..." And then I circle a few things and draw a few arrows and then write a second equation that's, you know, equivalent to the first. And then he gives me this look and his eyes get big and he's like, "Oh, okay." And then I do that a few more times and show like, "Okay, you know, we do this because we want this at the end. You know, we want Y equals at the end. And so here's how we move things around." But I did that just by sort of pointing out in the equation things that I was doing. And once I did that, he understood it perfectly. And, you know, did all of his work perfectly, never had any trouble with it again.
Hmm.
And I think what that really shows is two things. One, it's that, you know, when you are trying to teach something, you need to be able to do something in essentially an infinite number of ways, because you have no idea what will make sense to any given student. And the other thing is, I guess, more specific to the teaching of math, and that is to respect and use the expressive power inherent in math, and sometimes just use that and avoid natural language entirely. Because...
Yeah.
You know, every student has strengths and weaknesses, and you need to acknowledge this. That's not something you're going to be able to change in the class, is what those strengths and weaknesses are in, like, any individual lesson. What you can do is try and play to their strengths. If someone, like this student, has extremely good abstract reasoning skills, and just show them the equation, show them how the equation is changing. And that will make sense to them. That wouldn't have made sense to probably anyone else in that class, but it worked for him.
Well, one other thing that you had told me about this was that, I think it's important... important enough to repeat here, is that there's a... It's very tempting to project stupidity where it doesn't belong.
Right. If a student doesn't get something the first time that you explain it to them, there is probably a 0% chance they are stupid. If they don't get it after three different ways, that chance is still probably zero. Everyone has, you know, two people are very likely to have different modes of thinking, different modes of problem solving, different ways of just analyzing information. And if yours doesn't match with a student's, then what is natural and intuitive to you will be baffling to them, and this does not make them stupid. And if you think it does, do not go into teaching. Because you to teach effectively.
Okay, okay, like, you've trod upon this.
Okay.
I was trying to... One of these days, I will figure out how to cook out of you things that you have told me before.
Well, I swear to God. Instantly as soon as I say them. That's what speaking is forgetting.
Speaking is for... Oh, right, right. You print the words in your head, and then they come out the mouth, and they leave. They're gone forever.
Yes.
Well, I carve words into my... What you were on about before was that it doesn't matter what language you talk to people in, they pretty much get when you're talking down to them.
Any student, you know, will know when you were talking down to them. It's extremely obvious when the teacher and student share, you know, a native language, but still pretty obvious
still pretty
when
obvious.
They don't. There are enough cues other than mere... diction to let them know that the teacher isn't taking them seriously, and students tend to dislike that.
Yeah, not at all a way to win hearts and minds. Okay, well, that was pretty good. Glad to
now for the other thing.
Which is still a Q&A session of sorts, I think. Because we're going to review the remaining cards from Gate Crash.
Yes, we skipped three of them.
We did.
Three was the number of the skipping.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to start with a card named Enter the Infinite.
Yes, it's a tremendously
silly
card.
Do you mind rattling that one off for us?
All right, let me bring it up on the Gatherer, just to make sure I get the exact text right. Enter the Infinite. You get to hear me typing a bunch. Ah, yes! Enter the Infinite. This is a sorcery that costs 8 and 4 blue mana. Draw cards equal to the number of cards in your library, then put a card from your hand on top of your library. You have no maximum hand size until your next turn.
That's it?
Yep.
That's all it says?
That's Enter the Infinite.
What does the flavor text say?
Don't just have an idea, have all of them. Niv-Mizzet, Draco Genius.
Oh no, I slammed my keyboard into light, and somehow multiple menus came out. Huh? How did I... Wait.
I've altered your computer, Kat.
I don't... That shouldn't be possible. Whatever. Anyway, before I launch in on my own diatribe about how Enter the Infinite is... I'm going to quote something at length.
Set the Wayback Machine.
Read. Yeah, we're setting the Wayback Machine to June 22nd, 2007 in an Ask Wizards article, which should be linked, and if I've forgotten to link it, then that's bad on me. But anyway, you should be able to find it easily enough by... A few carefully chosen keywords, like I've done just a minute ago. Something like, draw 100 cards, ask wizards.
Yes.
That should take you right to it. Because here we go. Question from... a little bit of stage setting here. Asks... Blah, 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 blah. Why do I want to say asks?
Because that's what we always say.
Asks.
Asps.
Yeah, multiple asps, snakes who are crawling around my body. Ask Wizards was a small column on the Mothership, the main daily MTG magazine homepage, the official one from Wizards, where listeners would ask questions like you do of us and the Skulls asked, and they post their answers, and it's supposed to be, little insider glimpse into what's going on, and rational answers to obvious questions and all that. And I take that at face value, and for the longest time took it as basically gospel for how to design Magic cards. And I still pretty much do, because this is, like, from the lion's mouth, as it were. So I take it in all, like, sincerity, their answers. So the question on June 22nd 2007 was from Dan.
Dan.
Who asked
Thanks, Dan.
How much would a spell with the text draw 100 cards cost? And the answer from Noah Wheel of Magic R&D goes like this. 4 and a blue. But seriously, Dan, what you've got is unprintable. Logistically, it would be quite time-consuming and obnoxious to count out 100 cards. While I appreciate the number makes it niche, as opposed to draw 20, which could go anywhere, the power level still implies broken and or extremely unfun. To explain, let's go with a common R&D puzzle. What's the mana cost of this card? GG. Sorcery. You win the game. The answer here is there is no correct casting cost for this card. No matter what you put in the upper right corner, this card should never be made. For one reason, as worded, the card is intrinsically overpowered. It could cost 100. We still make plenty of cards that let you cheat on mana. Dream Halls, Sins of the Past, Fist of the Suns, etc. all have their fans. A card like this not only looks savage next to those gems, it curtails future design. Sure, you could have some hacky clause like, if you didn't pay 11 blue blue black black red green to play this card, it's countered. The editing and development teams could probably make a card that wouldn't break standard or the eternal formats wide open, although a mistake would be very unfortunate. Phage does say you win the game on it, and Legacy is as healthy as it ever was. Power level arguments are just an aspect of this card's real issue, a concern Phage neatly avoids. GG is about the least interactive card in the history of the game. Combos are okay in small amounts, but a one-piece combo is anathema to everything Magic tries to do. Imagine this exchange. Friend A. I got out my second Mana Echoes at just 4 life. He had a trained Armadon, and you know I was scared of Giant Growth or Berserk, friend B, or even Feral Instinct. Right, but he didn't have any of that. I got to start my turn at 1 life, I had all these lands in play from his New Frontiers, so I tapped 12 mountains and played Firecat Blitz for 10. That was worth a lot of mana, so I tapped 2 more mountains and played another Firecat Blitz for 200. Friend B. You attacked for 200? That's pretty awesome! I couldn't, he had Barbed Foliage out. Instead, I tapped my last mountain and sacrificed everything to flash back one of the blitzes. How much mana did you have then? Good question! At the end I had 225 cat tokens, 9,922,500 colorless mana, and a single red. So I hit him with a blaze for 9 million. 9 million? It was a little excessive since he was at 63, but why not, right? So awesome. Indeed it is, friend B. R&D loves cards that can create a story, which healthy combo cards do. How many games is it worth playing to get a story like the above? The more implausible the situation, the more thrilling when you pull it off. Contrast with the GG card above. Friend A. I was on the ropes, but got enough mana to cast GG, so I did. Friend B. Yawn. Well played. It's not engaging, it's not exciting, and it's certainly not clever. Back to the original card. Draw 100 cards is about half a step away from you in the game. You're not playing this to refuel, you're playing it solely to draw every combo piece with quad force of will backup. While we appreciate the thought experiment, these kinds of cards do not promote good gameplay. As worded, no mana cost would be appropriate. Thanks for the excellent question, Dan. And,
okay, so they printed it and it's 12?
Yes.
12. 12 mana. 4
of
it blue.
Right. What started off as a perfectly answered, unask your question is now answered as 12.
Yes. 12. In a standard format with omniscience legal.
Yes. And that's not the one I really worry about, but rather exactly what Noah Wheel said here, you know. Draw every combo piece with quad force of will backup.
Yeah.
There are already omniscience decks in Legacy.
Yes.
They're casting things that are worse than the one that lets you cast everything. And yarg. Yarg, I'm cursed.
Yarg.
I was so perplexed when I first saw Enter the Infinite. I thought it couldn't be real. And not in the good, like, oh wow, this will be so awesome to play sense, but in the, hey, I remember this, them saying that they would never do this. I had a firmly held belief in the integrity of design, as if they're, you know, the rules about this stuff that I was learning were real and made sense and had, like, logical underpinnings that you could follow and eventually develop your craft, you know? This was when I wanted to be a magic card designer, and I was paying very close attention to all this nonsense. I no longer so want to be that quite so badly.
You don't want to be that guy.
Because I've contented myself that I'm basically more competent at it than the people who do it for real, and that what comes out of Wizards of the Coast is just this steady stream of lies to make everybody who plays the game of Magic content for a little while, for like a year, and then the next year they can do something completely different, and the fan base that they have will always forgive them and always come back, and they'll always retain them, and we can be lied to again and again and again, and some of us are not bright enough to pick up on it, and some of us just don't care. And we'll just play whatever is there, whatever is real. It makes it very hard to postulate cards and to get a good audience for possible cards. Especially from people who were doing the same kind of reading as I was and were on the other end of things, where I was picking up and accumulating these rules little bit at a time, you know, like guide to design. No one else seemed to care about that crap. And so even among, like, magic players, there are magic players who want to play imagination games like you design the card. And then among those, there are people who are like unto me, who care about the rules of design, and then the rest of them don't. So I'm on this tiny little island of thought, and it is terribly, terribly isolating. I would do things like, I would design a creature, and then people would come back to me, that's broken, that's overpowered, that's busted. And I would say, well, no, not really, because if you compare it to, like, three existing creatures at least, then it doesn't rate all that bad. And sure enough, like, not the next year, they would print a creature who was just wildly powerful than the one I had designed, and no one ever kicked up a fuss then.
No, because we gotta make creatures more powerful.
Because it's coming from the source. Because it's coming from them.
Yeah. They say creatures are more powerful now.
Yeah, then it just happens. I'm like, what is a Loxodon Smiter? What? But Loxodon Smiter,
like,
and
people don't even think about Loxodon. He's alright.
I know! This is a 3-mana 4/4 with all upside.
With downsides and possible upsides.
Hey, no one blinks a bloody eye at that guy. Yeesh. Man. Enter the Infinite.
Enter the Infinite. So you draw essentially all. Well, you do end up having drawn every card, but then you put one back, so it's like you drew all but one card, but you choose which card you didn't draw.
Yeah, and really the only reason that really weird and kind of terrible clause is on there is so that you don't immediately lose the game the next turn.
Yes.
Which I think makes it even worse.
You think it should have to be a more all-in gambit?
Yes. I think for one... Enter the Infinite would be better if it simply said that first sentence, like, draw cards equal to the number of cards in your library. Full stop. Right there. Because then you're faced with some really hard choices after you resolve your 12-mana sorcery.
Right.
And then it becomes interesting.
You need to somehow get cards back in your library, or you need to win the game.
Right. But when you have this 12-mana sorcery that gives you a free turn to win, and it doesn't even, like, make you discard things. That's stupid! This is so stupid!
It's a little dumb.
It's like they included this extra awful language
goofy.
Just to bug fix a card that should not exist in the first place, and they've gone on record saying it shouldn't. Don't anyone get back to me with, Oh, well, it's functionally different from draw 100 cards.
Yeah, because you can't motor yourself with it.
Yeah, because it's better.
Like, draw 100, like they said, you know, draw 100 cards is niche, because you can't run that in your 60-code deck without dying a bunch unless you're, I get, okay, so he didn't know about Lab Maniac back in 2007. I think I can forgive him for that. But it's this goofy, like,
yeah, I want to say
that
even
sort
with
of says,
the...
like, skip your current turn to, like, have the flip-out turn next turn? Because, like, 12 mana... If you're paying 12 mana legitimately, that's probably all of your mana.
Yeah, that's kind of the situation they've constructed, is the ramp spell deck that... lets you tap out for 12. Man.
Yeah. And you'd be like, okay, you know, if I live through whatever my opponent does on their next turn... My deck is constructed such that with 12 mana and my library at my disposal, I will crush them. And so... I mean... Is it 12 mana, like...
You know what else was an interesting draw your deck experience and a fun one?
What? Which one?
Ad Nauseam.
Yeah!
That's
that was pretty cool.
That's a thrilling
cool
card.
Because that carries risk.
It does. And
so
it is...
there was tension at every choice of do I keep going or not.
Yeah. And it's thrilling, and it warps the construction of your deck around it.
Yes.
And that's totally fine.
Yes.
And Ad Nauseam has never been a real problem, even though it's been quite powerful.
It is powerful, but... I want to say perceived as, like, reasonably so.
Yeah.
There is a cost and there is a risk, and you can still get donked up afterwards.
Importantly, it plays with your resources in such a way that even any deck can put pressure on the Ad Nauseam player just by dealing them damage.
Yes.
Because every bit of damage they take is less damage that they can... less life that they can give to their Ad Nauseam when they're finally trying to go off. Whereas, what do you even do? How do you fight an Enter the Infinite player?
Mill them.
What, the timely mill spell? You mill them out so that they draw fewer cards when they draw their entire library?
Well, like, they draw their library, and then it's like, okay, so my turn, mill two.
Okay.
Good game.
But they're going to have all their free counter spells that they can play for nothing.
Yeah, pretty much.
So it has to be, like, Nephalia Drownyard.
Yeah. Which I guess you just don't play Enter the Infinite into.
Right, because that's trick on board. So you would have to sandbag the Nephalia Drownyard. Yeah. And I think what I'm getting at is...
Not every deck can do this. Like, are we talking about... Eternal formats, are we talking about standard, are we talking about both?
I don't think it really matters, because in the context of the discussion, I was saying that you can fight Ad Nauseam by dealing damage.
Right, you fight Enter the Infinite by...
By having Nephalia Drownyard in your hand.
Nephalia Drownyard, or I guess killing them before they hit 12, if they're not cheating it out.
Right, but they're cheating it out.
They're cheating it out because they're smart.
Because no one's going to pay 12 mana for this.
No. At just most, like, how much is Omniscience? That's how much they're paying.
8, I think.
8. Okay, so they're paying 8 for this.
Yeah, far more reasonable than 12.
Yeah. Oh yes.
I mean,
it can happen.
And I'm the guy who is paying, like, 10 and 15 for my win-the-game spells.
Like, what were the ultimatums? Those were 7 or 8.
Those were all 7.
7.
It was always... C C D D D E E for the costs.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And those, like, Cruel Ultimatum was extremely powerful. There were decks whose game plan was cast Cruel Ultimatum.
Yeah.
Because
or even like cast Cruel Ultimatum with negate backup.
Yeah.
So like really they cost 9.
9. And like Cruel Ultimatum, in certain board states, said win the game. And there are lots of cards that say in certain board states win the game, that's fine. in certain board states, Omageddon wins the game.
Oh, yeah. That's four mana.
That's one of the classic codes that's like, sometimes I will just win the game.
Yeah, you're ahead on board then, and then you just lock it.
Yes. Enter the Infinite panders to the idea of the idiotic blue wizard with a billion counter spells and some idiotic other thing going on. And, you go and you draw your library, and then you either have Omniscience out and win right there, or you say go, and I have to scramble to try and murder you when you likely have free or fake free spells in your hand, because blue loves those, and try and scramble and murder you before you get your untapped step.
Yeah,
and get
just
combo out.
It's apostasy. That's it.
What does apostasy mean?
Apostasy is like when the church does a sin.
Oh, when it's, and then they say whoops. Do they apologize when they do that?
Oh hell no. No one has ever apologized for apostasy.
I don't know how the church works.
Being the king means never having to say you're sorry.
So it's like, I mean, on one hand, I guess, okay, here are the good feelings I have about this card, is that the 12-year-old is going to feel cool as hell when he actually pays 12 mana for this and then has something idiotic work in their, like, kitchen table game or whatever. And it'll be fun the first time. The first time in the group of 12-year-olds, one of the guys resolves to enter the Infinite and does something insane. Mm. Everyone will say, wow, cool.
The only good feeling I have about this card is that it gets much more exciting to cast under Hive Mind. And I...
Ooh, yes it does.
I want to do that once.
You want to do that. You want everyone to get nuts.
Yeah, the same way that I loved casting Doomsday under Hive Mind and being like, okay, this game ends soon. I will make it.
Actually, I think... Yeah, Main Joke Expert is pretty well equipped to deal with someone Hive Minding Enter the Infinite onto it. Because it's a blue deck.
Right.
But also because it's a combo deck. And it's like, oh, thanks for...
Yeah,
cards.
I mean, the cool part about that is that, like, you kind of sneak around the no discard clause, because then their turn begins and they can discard cards again.
Yes.
But they won't, because they will have definitely drawn their reliquary tower, so that's not even a thing either.
This card just feels awkward. That's the word for this card. It's an awkward card.
Like, even in the best light, it doesn't work. And it has this built-in bug fix, and it's still awful. Ugh. Every part of it that I can imagine is just terrible. It's one of those things that doesn't look good from any angle.
I kind of like the art.
Okay, it looks fine from that angle.
Shoutouts to Therese Nielsen.
Yeah, keep drawing magic cards. Like Elvish Warrior? Not Elvish Warrior, what was it? Elvish Scout?
I forget.
From, like, Alliances. Anyway, let's move on to another card from Gatecrash.
Okay.
Gideon, Champion of Justice.
Gideon, Champion of Justice, is a planeswalker named Gideon, who costs 2 mana and 2 white mana, plus 1. Put a loyalty counter on Gideon, Champion of Justice, for each creature target opponent controls. 0. Until end of turn, Gideon, Champion of Justice, becomes an indestructible human soldier creature with power and toughness, each equal to the number of loyalty counters on him. He's still a planeswalker. Prevent all damage that would be dealt to him this turn. Minus 15. Exile all other permanents.
Right. Do you have any idea how hard it is to fight back a planeswalker who starts at 4 on turn 4 and goes up?
I'd imagine. Well, it's hard to say.
It's somewhat... I mean, back in the day, it was hard enough to fight, like, Jace or a Johnny.
Yes.
And that was supposed to be the, like, balancing feature of Planeswalkers, was it was like, oh, you know, they already interact with the game of Magic because you can attack them with your creatures.
Yes.
Never mind how incredibly detrimental it is to direct your attacking power towards something other than your opponent when you're the deck that's attacking.
Yes.
If Gideon, Champion of Justice, does nothing more than eat a few attacks, he's already done his job.
Mm.
He's probably more than done his job. And that's extremely hard to do with Gideon here. It's hard enough to do with any given Planeswalker, and it's just much, much more difficult with Gideon here. Because he's going to start life at 6, and probably...
Most days of the week, yeah.
Probably going to start at much higher than that. He works fine on an empty board. He works fine on a full board. I guess I want, like, a pithing needle that says Gideon on it. And I want more spells that say, like, Dreadbore or something, that say Destroy Gideon. Oh, he still does the trick of turning into a creature, like
yes.
Previous Gideon, which is, I guess, his shtick.
Yes.
And in that sense, this is a good design, because it feels like this is something that he does among Planeswalkers.
That's the Gideon ability, is turning into a man and getting in the red zone.
Yeah. But this time around, he has an extra line in there to further bug fix his ability. Most things don't need to both be indestructible and have all their damage prevented. But wouldn't you know it, those sneaky planeswalkers with their extra rules, where if you damage them, you remove loyalty counters.
Yeah.
So you could find yourself in the ignominious position of, dealing damage to an indestructible thing and having it die anyway because the damage removes loyalty counters and then they're gone. It used to be that you could just smite Gideon.
Yes.
Rise of the Eldrazi, you would attack and you'd be like, okay, I block him. Smite! I smote your planeswalker. But now this time around he's like, I'm indestructible! I am the most invinciblest dude. Check out these muscles.
Oh, do you even lift, bro? And then lift bro says, I don't know, Gideon.
Never mind how awful the name Gideon, Champion of Justice, is. It's way too cheesy.
I would believe it more if you were wearing a wrestling championship belt. Then
seriously.
I would be okay with that name. Then that name would be fine.
He needs it there, and we need another... Planeswalker who's like a luchador mask. I guess Garruk then?
Yeah,
he's got the...
Gailey is definitely... could definitely be a pro wrestler.
He definitely could be.
And he'd also be like, Koth.
Oh man, we got all kinds
of... Yeah, we have 3 pro wrestlers. So far. We need, I guess, a blue and a black pro wrestler.
So it goes without saying that this Gideon also has sawdust for brains, and I'm not gonna... really respect anything he does, and he's just as much of a moron as all the other planeswalkers.
Didn't he just, like, straight up enlist with the Boros?
Yeah, he did, because he's like, whoa, a fiery angel lady. She's definitely about justice. Let me do this. Like, why are you... What
Gideon,
stake do you have in anything?
The fucking 5-0.
You know, if it's him perpetrating the massive raid, I think I'm okay with that.
Is it swinging in through a window?
Which, mysteriously, Massive Raid is pretty okay against Gideon.
Yeah, that sort of
like,
makes
no.
His plus one look sort of doofy.
No.
It's like, no.
As for how often you'll actually get to, like, minus 15, that's not going to happen.
No.
But just getting him to, like, 6 or 7, and then having him be this indestructible, invincible 7-7 who's always attacking.
Yeah. That's pretty alright.
That's annoying. I had to fight through a, like, Gideon 1.0 who was getting jumped by Elspeth every turn. Which is just vile.
Planeswalker fastball special.
I guess Gideon and Ajani here could do the same thing. They're 3 and 4. Not even 4 and 5. Ugh.
Nice.
Ugh. Like, Gideon shows up and becomes a 7-7 or whatever. And then it's like, Ajani, jump him. Double strike. You don't need any other cards.
No, you really don't.
Yeah.
So that's Gideon, champion
of
justice.
That's Gideon. I don't like him that well. I know he's going to be miserable to fight against, and I'm glad that Dreadbore exists. So our last card from Gatecrash to talk about today is named Domri Rade. Raid.
Domri Raid is a planeswalker named Domri. He costs 1, a red and a green. Starts with 3 loyalty. +1, look at the top card of your library. If it's a creature card, you may reveal it and put it into your hand. -2, target creature you control fights another target creature. -7, you get an emblem! With creatures you control have double strike, trample, hexproof, and haste.
Yug. Double strike. Haste.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Double strike, trample, hexproof, haste.
Well, that's pretty backbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's an ultimate.
Almost realistic at, like, start 3, -7.
Yeah. But then his -2 is so good, you'll probably...
It is.
Using that at least a few times.
I mean, it -2 that murders a creature.
Yeah.
Domri is pretty tight.
Yes, he is.
He's pushing
the bounds. I used him a tiny bit in a exhibition match against Kaz.
It was an exhibition match, wasn't it?
Yes. Turns out that if your deck's full of creatures, +1 says, you know, draw a card and reveal it.
Yeah. I mean, he's pushing the limits of what a 3-mana planeswalker, a 3-mana card of any kind, can be power level-wise.
Hmm.
And that's really astounding in a world that also has Loxodon, Smiter, and Oblivion Ring. And what other busted 3-mana things do we have? I mean, I guess Show and Tell exists, and that's pretty busted.
Flirt. Who knows, man.
Madness. This guy should cost 4. I like the design. I like all of his abilities, how they work together, how...
He's about creatures.
His ultimate ability is cleverly crafted so that it's not an immediate victory, but rather a probable one. You know, you get... It has an emblem, and emblems are neat, I guess.
It makes your creatures good. So if you have a bunch of creatures, you probably do win right away. But
if you don't,
you got some work to do.
If Koth is the mountain man, then Domri Raid is creature guy, because his abilities say creature, creature, creature.
Oh, wait... Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. The word creature appears 4 times.
Yeah, he is definitely creature guy. My only remaining criticism of Domri Raid, and use this guy, my god. Especially since you can pretty easily mono ramp into him with an elf.
Yeah, like, turn 2 Domri is
going to be busted.
That's a little terrifying.
That's the world that we live in now. And he starts life at 4, too, basically.
More or less.
Ugh.
You know, unless there's something you need to kill off immediately, which is also fine, that then he's a removal spell.
Right, like 3-mana, kill a thing, possibly get other value, busted. Yeah. So good. You need to have the creature in the first place. But you will, because you're playing a Domri Raid deck.
Yes.
You're going to overload on creatures, and there are enough good creatures that exist to be able to do it. Oh, I guess I could risk cascading into this guy off a Bloodbraid Elf. Oh, well.
Wouldn't that be a shame?
I guess I'll have to live with that.
If you get a free Planeswalker?
Yeah.
Oh, but it could be awkward if you've already got one. And then they go away. That would be awkward.
Well, then you wouldn't cast it. You get the option.
Oh, right. Cascade, you get to choose. Then, okay, then it is simply a whiff on your Bloodbraid Elf.
Yeah, and, you know, that's happened since long ago. That kind of duck.
Cry about it, Bloodbraid Elf player.
It's like, oh no, the one time at Bloodbraid didn't return Vengevine. Guess I'll just have to live with Domri Raid here. Then his Kitchen Finks attacked my Kitchen Finks. I was sad. Fighting
and challenge.
Yeah, I think this is a good, if too powerful, dude. A little too powerful.
Well,
I'm okay with putting this kind of power in the hands of red. I don't think green really needs
red,
it.
Red, green, so like creature-y colors that aren't really like green has Thragtusk right now. Red doesn't have too much going for it right now.
Nah.
Ultimately, like he is like, you know, very powerful for 3-mana walker. Does not on his own defeat your opponent. You know, he is on an empty board, he's just drawing you cards sometimes.
Yeah, and in a deck with no creatures, he does stone nothing.
Yes. So, like, he's forcing you to play a creature deck.
That's...
Which is not bad, but it is a requirement. He's not just this, you know, run me all the time card. He's a run me if your plan is X card. And I think that's, like... And even if your deck is jam-packed full of creatures, you're going to hit land sometimes off the plus one. I'm just saying that it's not like a perfectly consistent plus one draw card. It is merely a good, reasonably consistent plus one draw card.
Yeah, it's like plus one draw a third of a card.
Yeah.
Or maybe even half a card.
Your
Yikes.
Creatures more better. But your creatures need to already be, like, pretty alright. And be in existence. No, he seems strong. I wouldn't be surprised if he starts making the rounds in standard.
Yeah, no doubt.
Creature guy.
But there's one remaining thing. This is a nitpick.
Okay.
His card is wrong.
How is his card wrong?
It's wrong.
What's wrong about it?
The illustration.
Oh, something's missing.
A lot of something.
A lot of something. So they got this, like, sassy pose.
And the pose is alright.
Which is adequate.
And he's the only thing there in the artwork. I mean, the focus is clearly on him.
Yes.
But it's wrong.
Wait, no, I found the thing that I thought was missing. It's on top of his stick.
Oh, Not that.
Oh, okay.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
That's very right with his
card.
Okay. What I mean is that in all other Planeswalker cards, even freaking gigantic dragon man Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, the focus of the card has been on the person, and the person has taken up so much of the space of the card that they don't even fit in anymore, and part of their... like, drawing pops out over the rest of the card, because it's so zoomed in on them. Domri Raid is much further out than that.
Yeah.
We've panned out, and you'd think, okay, well, that buys us a little room to be able to show other stuff about him, right?
Like, maybe a horde of creatures.
Right,
but
they didn't do that. And instead, there's just this behind him, there's only the thing that's somewhat right about this that partially redeems it is a gigantic mammoth skull.
Skulls